history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are men and women in your midst with incredible stories to tell. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we are educated every time. We're entertained and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you caught our last episode, you heard a little bit from 95-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley, how his mother left them when he was just one, how he was turned down by the Navy initially for being too short, but just had to get away from the stepmother he despised, and he chopped down trees in an upstate New York CCC camp until he was big enough for the Navy to take him. We even heard how decades after the war, he met Matsuo Fuchida, who had orchestrated and led the aerial attack on Pearl Harbor. And now we're going to hear from Stu what he experienced on December 7th, 1941.
I've heard many people say Pearl Harbor was a defeat. I don't agree with them. My opinion is it was an eye-opener because the minute Nimitz took command, he followed Admiral Yamamoto's procedure. He built the battle fleet around the aircraft carrier.
Big change in strategy.
Yes. And you see, the aircraft had come into its own. It was amazing because in talking to Fuchida, he clued me in that instead of using conventional bombs, which would never penetrate five steel decks to get to our handling rooms, he used armor-piercing shells and 15-inch armor-piercing shells. And in the torpedo deal, where we've got 35 and 40 feet of water in the harbor, he redesigned the torpedo by taking the elevator and the rudder off, which are steel, and put wooden ones on to give it buoyancy.
Yeah.
But then we've got a 16-inch armor belt from the after steering to the anchor windlass room. He's got to get through that. So he put a double warhead on the torpedo. In doing that, it stretched the torpedo out, so when they dropped them from the air, instead of going down 50 feet under the water, they went about 20, 25 feet underwater. When they were coming at us, we could see them coming through the water. My buddy, Johnny Anderson, he was in a motor launch coming alongside the gangway. When he saw one of those torpedoes, he pulled his boat up alongside the armor belt, jumped up on it, stuck his head and shoulders through a porthole. When that torpedo hit the side of our ship, the force of the water drove him right on through. He got up, ran topside, jumped over, and swam ashore. The Navy didn't know that. He was supposed to have been in turret 3 in the left gun, and if he had, he would have been burned beyond recognition, like 11 men were.
And I know you're going to tell us how close you came to being killed that day, but before we move away from Fuchida, I'm just wondering, since I've interviewed so many vets and I've heard the whole spectrum of feelings for the enemy then and now, you met the man who was responsible for the deaths of more than 2,000 Americans and almost claimed your life too. So what was that like for you?
You're going to be astounded. I never had a hatred, any animosity toward the Japanese. And I'll tell you why. I lived for a whole year out in Kamiki, and we had a Japanese maid, a Japanese gardener, husband and wife, and a darling little boy. And I loved them. I looked at it this way. When I was manning my battle station, you know, they're doing what they're told to do, just as I'm told. Because when I went to get my hat put on my head, I thought I was going to be with a fire and fighting away fire and rescue party. And when I reached for my hat, I got kicked right in the seat of the pants by a first-class bosun mate, Hicks. Get to your battle station on the double. This is the real thing. I grabbed my hat and ran on topside. Planes are diving from every direction. And similar to this, a gun sits up off the deck, and it's all open underneath. I saw this pilot, Lieutenant White, shooting with his 45. Well, I dove under there with him. Now, I'm a seaman first class. He's a lieutenant commander, so I'm not going to question. But I'm thinking. And he says, son, where's your battle station? And I put it up to gun three. He says, get up there as fast as you can. As I was going up the ladder to get in the turret, here come a Japanese torpedo plane down the port side. I could see the pilot, the radioman, and the co-pilot laughing like everything. I got inside the turret, and Krausen was already in the trainer's seat. Nobody was up on the gun deck, no shellman or rammers or anybody. So I went down to my battle station. When I go out to the schools, I put on a little demonstration. I point out how the Lord protected me. When I was 9 years old, I used to like to sit in the chair and lean back on the back two legs. My dad only spoke twice. Third time he acted. And you, yes, sir, and no, sir, in our house. So I was in the kitchen, and I'm leaning back on the back two legs. My dad walked in. Stuart, they made four legs and a chair to sit on the floor. Yes, sir. But how quick a 9-year-old forgets. So next time I'm leaning back, my dad says, Stuart, I'll not tell you again. Yes, sir. In this ear and out that ear. So the next time I'm leaning back, my dad walked in the kitchen, kicked the bag leg out from underneath me. I cracked my head on the floor. I said, there's got to be a better way. Now you see my legs back up under. That's 9 years old, a habit that I learned. I'm now 20 years old, and I'm in my battle station. Normally, my feet would be on a platform. I would be bent over cranking in the dials for the elevation that they want that gun raised.
And this is a big 16-inch gun.
16-inch cannon.
How big are the projectiles in that?
It stands 5'2". It's 16 inches in diameter. They weigh 2,700 pounds. I called it a Volkswagen going out the barrel. And it takes 5 100-pound bags of black powder to hurl that shell from San Diego to Oceanside. That is, if I've got that gun elevated to maximum height, that shell will fly 30 miles.
I just wanted people to have a sense of this isn't a little anti-aircraft gun. This the biggest you got.
So now I'm in my battle position, but we're not going to fire these 16-inch guns in Pearl. We'll blow Pearl Harbor off the map.
Yeah.
And so consequently, my feet were back up underneath me. I'm on a high stool. No back. J.A. phones on. And we could hear the machine gun bullets hitting the turret. We felt the thud of a torpedo. And Krausen says, Stu, let's see what's going on. We took the sight cap off our periscope and bam, there went the Arizona. And I estimated there were about 32 bodies that flew through the atmosphere.
So I want people to understand what you're saying here, because very few people actually saw the Arizona
explode.
They saw the aftermath. They saw the smoke, or they heard it and they turned.
We saw it.
When you you looked into this viewfinder right before the bomb hit.
And see, I immediately thought that a bomb went down this stack, because it looked like the ship broke in half. When I met this fellow here, I found out the truth. Jack McCarran was one that was blown off the ship into the burning oil. But he later informed me that he had been informed that an armor-piercing shell went through the starboard side of the forecastle right into number one handling room. There's 1,000 bags of black powder in each one of the handling rooms. That exploded. That set off turret two. That's what broke the ship in half.
But you're a 20-year-old kid.
I'm a 20-year-old brat growing up overnight.
And you're looking at a ship just like yours, another battleship, blowing up and bodies flying through the air.
Yep.
How do you react to that?
Startled, surprised, but waiting for the next scenario.
Sure.
Because the next scenario was an armor-piercing shell dropped from a high-level bomber, came through our turret. And what he'd done, he took 15-inch armor-piercing shells. Mm-hmm. They welded fins on them so that they would spiral. Well, over top of our left gun is a catapult, and I called it a slingshot. And we had two airplanes on that catapult that morning. One was a scout observation plane, an SOU-2, and the other was the Kingfish, the Admiral's plane. Well, the scout observation is a biplane.
Yeah.
The top wing is the gas tank. The Admiral's plane is a single wing. And when that shell hit, it hit the top wing of the scout plane. The gasoline exploded, burnt the plane to a crisp, split that catapult in half, and came down through 5 inches of steel right into the left gun. And the reason I'm here today is because that shell did not explode. And here's a picture of it taken on December the 9th. That's the inside of the turret.
And I'll put this picture up at hometownheroesradio.com. And I think some people who've been paying close attention are doing the math or following your drift on this. But go ahead and connect the dots for me from don't sit on two legs of a chair to the reason you're still here.
When the Arizona blew up, we didn't know it at the time. 1,177 men died instantly aboard that ship. You ever been out to Pearl?
Sure.
You've been aboard the memorial?
Yes.
You've seen the onyx wall, the plaque, with 1,177 names. But since then, there's been about, I would say, pretty close to 50 to 100 bodies put inside the ship.
Right.
So right after that explosion, I had my feet back up under. Right by my feet is a hatch, just big enough for a person to crawl through from one side to the other. It's locked down with four steel dogs. It blew that hatch right off those four steel dogs, that explosion. My footrest was just torn right off. If my feet had been out where they would be, I would have no legs, and I probably wouldn't be alive.
You wouldn't have made it off the ship.
No. Nobody would have known we were there because there was only the two of us in that right gun. And went right past my legs, underneath the elevating screw, past Crozen's legs, and landed against the barbette, picking both of us up simultaneously and throwing us 8 feet back into the elevating screw. Now, I had the JA phones on, and when I picked myself up off the deck, Crozen says, "Stu, let's get out of here." So I said, "A good idea," only he didn't say it quite that nice. And in order to get out, you got to go up a ladder to the primer deck. And when I got to the primer deck, I'd reached the end of the cord, and I grabbed a hold of the belt, snapped it in half, and threw the whole thing down in the pit. I spent 20 years trying to stretch one of those belts. Couldn't do it. And it wasn't until after I retired that I understood how it was possible. And I show the kids the Inquirer magazine that I had. And it says a mother lifted a one-ton car up off her son. And I said, that's an impossibility. But I read the article. Then I understood. The adrenaline flows right through your body when you're in a state of excitement. So anyhow, we got on a topside. Our ship was on about a 15-degree list. Mm-hmm. And you can see the Tennessee is on one inboard of us. Now, a shell that hit the number two turret on the Tennessee killed my captain. Captain Banyan came out of his battle station, walked around the flying bridge over to the starboard side when a shell hit the edge of number two turret, and a piece of that shrapnel flew up and went through the lookout tower and tore my vice president's leg wide open. He got the Purple Heart. I never earned a Purple Heart for the whole war and the Korean War. And I told Crozen when we got out of topside, I says, if I don't get killed today, I'll live to see the end of this war. How can you say that, Stu? I said, if you've got the faith to believe it, you can do it. He says, I don't have that kind of faith. June 12th, 1942, he was on board the Honolulu. They took a torpedo through the bow of the ship. He was asleep in his bunk, and the steel crushed him to death.
And we're still in the early stages of this attack on the morning of Sunday, December 7th, 1941. You're up topside, but the reason you're saying if I survive today is that's not a certainty. There's still a lot going on. What happened next?
Well, while Crozen and I were watching the Oklahoma capsize, 12 minutes, Ensign Sears, a junior officer of our division, was screaming for us to get over on the Tennessee. And what he wanted us to do was to straddle the line and jimmy across. Well, while we were watching the Oklahoma go over, a plane zoomed in between the two ships and machine gunned all five of our buddies, and they just toppled in between the ship.
So they're on the line between the two ships.
Yeah.
And they get picked off like sitting ducks by these Japanese machine gun bullets.
Yep.
And I could see, as you described that, that the emotions are still stirred when you recall that.
Oh, yes. And I told Crozen, we're not going over any lines. How are we going to get over, Stu? I says, I don't know yet, but we'll find a way.
And wait till you hear what that way was. Time for our first break, but we'll journey back again to December 7th, 1941 with Stu Headley in a moment. Find photos of Stu then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 95-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley of Claremont, California. On December 7th, 1941, he was aboard the battleship USS West Virginia. And when we left off, he and a fellow sailor were trying to figure out how to escape their burning ship and get to the USS Tennessee nearby. They had just watched five of their friends try to cross on a line between the two ships, only to see them mowed down by machine gun fire from an enemy plane. Stu was determined to find another way across.
As I was watching the Oklahoma capsize, we had 5-inch 38 anti-aircraft guns that stuck out over the side of the ship. Mm-hmm. So I said, Crozen, did you ever run down a railroad track? He said, what are you talking about? I says, did you ever walk on a well, when I was a kid, I said, you're going to do it today. What do you mean? I said, you see that gun barrel? We're going to go over in the Marine casemate starboard side, climb up on that gun barrel, run across it, and jump down in the Tennessee. The gun barrel is about that big around.
Yeah, a couple feet wide.
Five inch. And so he says, you go first. I says, okay. So I usually ask the kids, where do you think I was going when I hit the deck of the Tennessee? They don't have it. I says, I was going right back up into turret 3. That's my battle station. You talk about Pavlov's law. And I was on the third rung when a Marine lifted me off with his foot. Crozen was still coming down the deck. And he said, haven't you had enough of those turrets? What do you want us to do? Get over in the beach. I says, how? Swim, you idiot. And the fire, as you saw in that picture just a minute ago, this is the oil that's blazing on the water.
Yeah.
from the ships. Crozen and I went over on the starboard side of the Tennessee. Here's all these nice, neatly piled clothes and shiny shoes. So I said, Crozen, we're going to strip down to our shorts, undershorts, and we're going to jump in. We're not going to dive. I says, we don't want to hit our head on anything. And I said, go just as deep as you can and swim underwater. Well, I qualified as an ABC swimmer in boot camp, not an underwater swimmer. But I'll guarantee I swam underwater that morning or I wouldn't be here.
How far did you have to go?
I would say about twice the distance we are to that wall. Not too far, but with that burning oil, and like I say, I wasn't an underwater swimmer. I came up twice, and I thrashed like mad to get that oil and fire away. Hottest breath I ever breathed in my life. It's a wonder it didn't scorch my lungs. Twice we broke surface the next time we were at the beach, and they took us right over to the dispensary and walked right across the deck, and it's a great big red cross. It's an open patio style with a deck all the way around with a railing. And we went up there. They examined us for any burns or any lacerations, any wounds of any kind. And they had tables and chairs and cots, a bed that they moved out, anything that they could put a body on. I was asked to speak out at UCSD. And this gal said, Stuart, when you get to the point where you were at the dispensary, I want you to tell, you're going to be speaking to 85 doctors, surgeons, their admirals and generals, and I want you to tell them what your supplies were that morning. I says, Kathy, you mean that? I said, they've got the finest of equipment and everything. Yes. I said, all right. So when I got to this point, they gave us a tube of unguentine ointment put on the burns. They gave us a jar of sulfa drug. That's to pour into the wounds and lacerations. Then they gave us morphine, cans of morphine, to minister to those that were dying or in dire pain. With those three items, we saved lives. Well, we were taking care of these fellows, and it's now about 9:25, and the second wave is coming in. And while we were taking care of these fellows, I looked up and I saw two planes approaching Fort Island. And I yelled, duck! And we went under the benches, the tables, whatever we could. And glass just shattered all over the place. And one of the planes, when it lifted up, dropped a bomb right in the center of that patio. Now, 59 years later, on a Tiger cruise, the year 2000, we went over to Hawaii. And I told the fellas, I want to go to that dispensary that I was in. So I walked right across the decking, walked up the stairs, and they're all dental offices across there now. I walked in, and these are corpsmen that are working with dentistry. And I said, 59 years ago, I was in this building. Those kids, what are you talking about? They didn't understand. They didn't know anything about the history of it. And I said, yes, 59 years ago, I was in this very building. Well, one of the dentists, who was a lieutenant commander, heard me. And he came over and he said, did I hear you right? You were in this building 59 years ago? That would have been December 7, 1941. I said, yes, sir. Come here, I'll show you something. I had walked right across that decking and I took a picture. These are the three fellows that were with me. And we stopped the car and we took photographs of the bullet holes down the landing field.
That are still there.
Yep.
Yep.
And this is a picture where I walked across the decking, but when he took me back down, I took a picture of what he showed me. That's where the bomb hit.
They have one tile in the floor there now that says, has a bomb, and it says December 7th, 1941.
Yep.
But on that date, I mean, this is a tile that's there now memorializing that.
Great big red cross was painted across that deck so that from the air, you would know that it was a dispensary or a hospital.
But that's exactly where they hit.
That's where they hit.
It was X marks the spot.
You better believe it.
What was the impact? What was the result of that bomb?
Well, dust flew all over everywhere, and I would say it was about 5 to 7, 8 minutes later that the dust cleared away. We looked over the banister. We didn't see a speck of red anywhere. Just literally tore that whole thing and turned it upside down.
The cross was gone.
Gone.
What about the patients that you guys had been treating?
They were still on the beds, but glass was all over them and everything. And there were about, I'd say pretty close to 50 to 100 fellows that were helping. They grabbed everybody they could, even those that were on Ford Island or those that came in off the ships.
Like you guys.
Yeah. And I'm going to put you to a test.
Uh-oh.
It's about 9:45. They told us you're needed back aboard ship to help fight fire. So they put us in a boat, took us back to our ship, and aboard the West Virginia, we had just gotten a new captain, Captain Benyon, and a new executive officer, Richard Hellencotter. And as soon as I got on the ship, the chief told me, Headley, you're going to handle the hose with the exec. He's going to handle the nozzle. You're going to hold the hose. When he cracked the hatch to the 3rd Division compartment, boom, boom, and I thought the Japanese are back, but it wasn't. The heat was so intense in the compartment that the moment he cracked that hatch and the air went in, it blew out our portholes.
Mm.
Took 45 minutes to cool that compartment down. And when we got it cooled down, I said, Commander, could I check my locker? He says, where's your locker, son? I said, right there in the corner. Go right ahead. I opened up my locker. There's my blues, my dungarees, my whites, my underclothes, my socks, a pair of shoes, my pea coat, a sweater, my hats, all stowed away just as neat as anything. But the minute I touched them, they turned to powder from the heat. And it was amazing because I opened up the drawer, and the stupidest thing, instead of sending my photographs home with the negatives, that locker drawer was just one mass of goo. Everything was gone. So then I opened the bottom drawer, and I had a pearl buckle in there because I was making square knot belts out of Belfast cord.
Uh-huh.
And there was a half penny. Now, the story about the half penny goes back to October the 11th. The battleship Warspite, British battleship Warspite, came into port. They volunteered a group of us sailors to go over and mingle. And I was assigned to this British sailor. And he said, I don't have much that I could give you, but come on down to my locker and we'll see what I can find. So he took out this half penny and he said, I'll give you this. And he said, you'll be in this war right alongside of us before long. I said, no. I said, we'll send you planes and tanks and ammunition. And I thought to myself, what a prophecy when I saw that half penny.
Mm.
And I've still got that half penny. I drilled a hole through it and put a chain in it.
Oh, I'd love to see it. You know, you've described all this, and I know you've told your story hundreds of times, if not thousands of times. And I can't imagine how many lives have been impacted by your willingness to tell this story. But I'm struck by how much detail you remember. And the one thing I'm trying to figure out is how? How did you do all this? How did you manage to keep on going? And how terrified were you with this situation that nothing could have prepared you for?
Yes, there was a preparation. Because, see, we were out there a whole year before the attack. And we had battle drills, we had gun drills, we had man overboard drills. We had all kinds of drills that we were continuously practicing. So when the real thing happened, we're prepared and we do just what we're trained to do. But and you Stu, don't stop. And
but, Stu, you saw bodies flying through the air. Then your body was blown back 8 feet. And you're holding your breath underwater because there's fire on the top. And you get to the beach. And when you get there, there's all these guys who are injured and maimed and dying. And you're treating them only to get bombed again where you're treating them. I mean, how can anything prepare you for that? And what
the
was
Lord.
It that, yeah, that was it.
The Lord prepared me for everything. He assured me, I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will be with you whatever you go through. That was where my faith was and my trust. That was all during the war. I went through 13 major engagements aboard the next ship, the San Francisco. The biggest battle we were in was Guadalcanal. Our ship was literally demolished. Eddie Huber and I were with damage control. We were electricians.
Mm-hmm.
We were assigned to go up and take over Gun 6. He was going to be the trainer. I was going to be the pointer. Gun 6 is the only gun that didn't get demolished. Gun 1, Gun 3, Gun 5, and 7 on the starboard side all took 14-inch shell hits. Gun 2, Gun 4, Gun 8 were wiped out. While we were on Gun 6, Gun 4 was destroyed. Joe Hubbard, who was our senior damage control officer, was walking on the deck behind us. When Gun 4 got hit, a piece of the shrapnel of the blast shield took his head right off his shoulders.
Oh.
He walked about 8 steps and then collapsed and died. We had 75% of our officers killed in 45 minutes aboard that ship. The admiral was killed, the captain was killed, the executive officer was killed, the gun boss was killed, Joe Hubbard, damage control officer, he was killed. We had 236 died that night. And the next morning, I was asked to help identify bodies. Well, we had a dog tag, two of them, on a chain around our neck. So I told Dr. Mamonis, I'll gladly do that for you. So I started with Gun 7, 5 bodies. And I opened their mouth, put the dog tag between their teeth, clamped their jaws shut, put a red tag on them. I come up to Gun 5. This is the most horrible experience of my life. I told you about Johnny Anderson, who was in that boat when he saw the torpedo wake, and he was supposed to have been in turret 3 in the left gun,
right.
But he wasn't there. Well, he was a pointer on this 5-inch 25, and the shell came right through and tore him in half. His head and shoulders were underneath the vent. His lower torso and legs were dangling. I started laughing, and Dr. Mamonis doubled up his fist and hit me as solid as he could in the jaw. And he said, Headley, you have every right to report me because an officer has no authority to strike an enlisted man. But if I hadn't have done it, you would have gone stark raving mad. Snap me out of it. I went ahead and continued identifying bodies up the starboard side and down the port. And shortly after, a fellow said, Headley, how about taking the watch in Central Station? This is about 10:30 in the morning, and I've got the JA phones on, and all of a sudden I hear 3 torpedo wakes on our port bow. I went up 5 flights of ladders, 5 decks, mm-hmm. Hit topside. Don Jenkins, first-class electrician, said, Stu, who's in Central Station? I said, no one. He went right down. Those 3 torpedoes passed between the Helena and the Frisco and hit the Juno. And in 9 seconds, clocked on our chronometer in the bridge, there was no ship afloat. Wiped right out. Turret 3, or turret 1, or turret 2, was spinning through the atmosphere. And Hoover, who was a senior officer on board the Helena, was not about to stop to pick up any survivors because the Frisco could make 8 knots. We were heavily damaged. So we proceeded right on to Espirito Santos. When we got in there, Hoover got a reprimand from Halsey like nothing for not attempting to pick up some of the men. But he told him, he said, I knew there was a submarine area. And he said, if I had dallied trying to get them, they could have picked us up.
Which would happen a little bit later on. That yeah. ship was sunk as well.
Yep. Well, we had five Medal of Honors awarded in one night aboard our ship. Admiral Callahan, Captain Casson Young, Commander Shondlin, Commander McCandless, and Robert Kepler, first class boatswain mate. And on my hat here is the Presidential Unit Citation. We were the first ship in the fleet to get that.
If you'd like to see a photo of that hat on Stu's head, go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. You'll even find three photos from the Pictures for Heroes project and links to what that's all about. These are really amazing high-resolution images of Stu reading from the journal he kept during World War II. From the West Virginia at Pearl Harbor to the San Francisco at Cape Esperance and Guadalcanal, he survived so many close calls. And as he shares the rest of his story, we'll get a taste of what he sees as the reason he survived and what drives him to continue telling his story today. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Loeffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the final portion of our discussion with a razor-sharp 95-year-old named Stu Headley. Born on a yacht in Florida, he grew up in Buffalo, New York. He spent the last six decades in the San Diego area, and for years he's been sharing his Pearl Harbor survivor story to schools and service groups in the region, and often at Shadow Mountain Community Church, where he's a pretty popular figure. You may have noticed that Stu's faith plays an integral role in the story as he sees it. If you missed our last episode, you can pull up the podcast at hometownheroesradio.com for the story of where that faith originated. But it's going to come into play again as we finish up his time on the cruiser USS San Francisco and segue into a moment of healing for the boy whose mother had left when he was one, replaced by a stepmother with whom he always felt at odds.
I stayed on the Frisco and went through the Battle of Atuinkiska.
Way up in the Aleutians.
Yep, from the southern tip down in Guadalcanal, the Coral Sea Battle, the Battle of Rabaul, the Battle of New Guinea, the Battle of Bougainville. Then we go into the North Pacific. And when we finished the campaign at Kiska and Attu, they sent us over into the Bering Sea. Mm-hmm. In between Alaska and Russia. That's when we went up through the Arctic Circle and we all become Blue Nose. But we were in water with waves 110 feet high and we were in the trough. We took a 57.5-degree roll. Captain France, who was a new skipper that we picked up in Frisco, was scared stiff. And he passed the word over the loudspeaker, all hands put on life jackets. That's engine room, pump rooms, deck force, everybody. He announced that he was going to attempt to bring the ship about into the waves so that we would not be rolling with them, but we would be pitching. And when the Salt Lake City was alongside of us, when she went down by the bow, all four of her screws are out in the atmosphere going. And that was the same way with us. And I heard the creaking of the ship, you know.
Sure.
And I thought, sure, we're going to break in half. And the chief told me, he said, Stu, don't worry about it. We have expansion braces for that very thing of allowing the ship to roll and pitch. So when we left the area of the Bering Sea in September, in October, we were in the Battle of Wake Island, and we recaptured Wake Island.
And sent a lot of prisoners free.
Yep. And when I got back to Pearl, I was supposed to go to new construction, but I wanted to stay in Pearl. I had a girlfriend there. Well, what happened was I ran into a fellow over at the receiving station who had orders for Pearl Harbor, but he didn't want to stay there. So I asked him, I said, would you be willing to go to the captain and see if we could get our orders changed. He said, would you go before the captain? I said, sure. So he said, all right, if you go, I'll go. So we went up, and I asked the captain, I said, this fellow here has orders to stay here in Pearl, but he doesn't want to. I have orders for new construction, and I don't want to go back. I want to stay here. Well, he was a second-class electrician, two hash marks. I'm a second-class electrician, two hash marks. And so he said, I don't see why we can't just verbally change your orders. So I got to stay in Pearl, and he went back to new construction. While I was in Pearl Harbor, though, I got a telegram, father seriously ill. I didn't want to leave because I didn't want to face that stepmother of mine. Captain told me, he says, son, the place is with your dad, and we can spare you. So you go up to the administration building, you pick out whatever school you want to go to. Well, I went up there, and I looked, and I wanted to go to IC school, but I didn't think I had the smarts. So I took gyro school. Little did I know I was going to go to three gyro schools in 1 year. So as it turned out, I attended gyro school here in San Diego. And when I was finishing up gyro school, they sent me a telegram, your father is turning very ill. So I went home to Buffalo. But between Toledo, Ohio, and Buffalo, God laid it upon my heart. You forgive her.
Your stepmother.
My stepmother. I said, all right, Lord, I'll obey you. So when I got to Buffalo, I normally would have called them and had them come and pick me up. But I took a cab out to the house, and instead of going to the front door, I went to the side door that has three steps up to the kitchen. Well, Henrietta was in the kitchen, and this is in March, and I got my pea coat on, and I didn't know what the situation was. But I saw Henrietta in the kitchen, and I ran up the steps. I grabbed a hold of her. I spun her around. I gave her a great big smoochie on the cheek, and I said, Mom, I forgive you. My dad was on a couch in the living room, and he saw the whole thing. A beautiful smile came over his face. But he later told me, you know, Stuart, I dreaded you coming home, knowing the hatred that you had for Henrietta. And I said, yes, Dad, but while I was in the CCCs, I asked Christ to come into my heart. And I said, I had that hatred towards her, but I said, I was on the train, and we were leaving out of Toledo, Ohio for Buffalo, and the Lord just indicated, I want you to forgive her. And I said, I'll do that. It was a relief because when I got married, I took my wife to Buffalo. She met Henrietta. We took Henrietta and her daughter's son to Niagara Falls. We had a wonderful time together. And one other area, this is April 5th, 1960. I still am a heavy drinker of alcohol. I am a heavy smoker. And I had just come back from Westpac aboard the USS Prairie, and I brought back $600 worth of booze. I had everything you could name. And my wife had just accepted the Lord about 2 months prior, and she was out witnessing to some of her friends. And all five of our children were in bed, and I was sitting in the living room reading my Bible, and I just blurted out, Lord, I won't listen to anybody tell me I shouldn't smoke and drink. You tell me, and I'll listen to you. So I was reading 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and I read the portion, Know ye not that your body is the temple of the living God? I said, Lord, I know that. And it was just like he said, read on. I read the next verse, 3:16. If any man, doesn't care who it is, if any man defiles this temple, him shall God destroy. I saw hardening of the arteries, tuberculosis, cancer, emphysema, all the ways that God destroys the body, not the soul and the spirit. And I said, Lord, I hear you. I got right up. I went in the bedroom. I got two cartons of Pall Malls. I had three open packs around the house. I put them all in a newspaper, put them in my fireplace, and lit a match. I went out in the kitchen, and I got that $600 worth of booze down out of the cupboard and poured it down the drain. Wanda walked in. Butch, what are you doing as I'm getting rid of this stuff? Well, why don't you give it to your brother or sell it to some of your shipmates? I said, sweetheart, if God doesn't want me to have it, he doesn't want anybody else to have it. She went in the bedroom crying. She got on her knees and asked the Lord to forgive her. The first time in 17 years that I got out of bed without a cigarette in my mouth. From that moment on, I've never had a desire for a cigarette or alcohol.
Wow.
And I thank the dear Lord for delivering me from that.
Well, we're running out of time, Stu. And I agree with Stan. You are incredible, and God's given you a gift. And I'm so thankful that you share it with so many people. There's a million questions I'd love to ask you, but I think a real important one is, why do you tell your story? Why do you go to these different groups? What is it that you're hoping people will understand and remember?
Well, I'll put it this way. It relates to our motto. Remember Pearl Harbor. Keep America alert. America is asleep. It has been ever since the beginning of World War II. Just to give you an example, 95% of the people of our country don't know what our boys went through. And I'll be honest with you, I'm part of that. Because when I see documentaries of what our SEALs went through, only they weren't SEALs, they were frogmen.
Yeah.
What they went through, what some of the Marines went through. I just saw the Carlson Raiders. Now, let me ask you, who was one of the famous people that was with the Carlson Raiders?
You tell me.
Franklin Roosevelt's son.
That's right.
He was with the Carlson Raiders.
Yeah.
And he almost got killed, but in the end of it, he killed two Japanese that were just about ready to bayonet him. And like I was going to ask you, did that name, Richard Helen Cotter, mean anything to you?
No, I don't know that name.
He was the first director of the CIA.
Aha. Uh-huh.
When he came aboard our ship, he was ONI. Office of Naval Intelligence, he'd yeah. come from. But I think it was 1946, I believe, he was the selected. And I asked him, when I went to visit him, I said, what is the CIA? He said, well, Congress decided that national and international intelligence gathering was too much for the FBI, because that's what they were doing. They were in Japan, they were in Germany, they were in Italy undercover,
yeah,
and they were gathering information. And even in Hawaii in October before the attack, when the Japanese let their top spy off in Honolulu, the FBI was right on him. Well, he said Congress felt it was too much of a load. So what they did, they split it. The FBI will do all national intelligence. CIA will do all international.
Right. Your brain is something, Stu. Not only your history, but you're cluing us in on Jimmy Roosevelt, FDR's son, who had some top secret duties before the war, and then, as you said, turned in those heroics in the 1942 raid of Macon Island with Carlson's Raiders. Also, Roscoe H. Hillencotter, who was your executive officer aboard the West Virginia at Pearl Harbor, and as you said, later, the inaugural leader of the CIA. But I have one more question about you, Mr. So Sharp and Youthful at 95. What is it that motivates you? What keeps you going?
The Lord. I get up in the morning and I thank him for the night's rest. And I ask him to give me the wisdom, guide and direct me to the people that he wants me to talk to, and give me the message that he wants me to share.
Well, I guess the one thing I have to say, Stu, is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this incredible story.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Stu Headley, 95 years young. Maybe you'll run into him in San Diego or in his worldwide travels in that appointment book that is way more jam-packed than mine is, that's for sure.
Remember to check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, including those three from Zach Coco's Pictures for Heroes project, striking shots of Stu reading from the journal he kept during World War II. There are also some links to learn more about Pictures for Heroes and the book that will eventually come out of all of Zach's efforts. So take a look and join us again next time when we're reminded again through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.